It's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Joel Pfister to today's Eribia seminar on memory and oblivion. As most of you know, Joel Pfister is visiting professor at the University of Caen this semester, and whenever I meet students or staff members and talk about our guest, they lavish praise on a charming and fascinating intellectual. Joel Pfister is an honorary professor of English and American Studies at Wesleyan University, and as some of you know, he began his graduate education in American Studies in Europe at the University of London, and he also studied at Columbia University, the University of Sussex, and he received his PhD in American Studies from Yale University. Professor Pfister is the author of 6 books published by Oxford University Press, Yale University Press, to name but 2 publishers. Not going to extend on that. He has lectured extensively in the United States, of course, in England, Italy, Denmark, Israel, France, Germany, Japan, Norway, and China. I'm going to end this introduction by saying that I'm really delighted to welcome my good friend Joel Pfister, who will, I'm sure, provide stimulating insights on movies and the Americanization of power. And the title of his paper is Thinking Through American Movies, American Exceptionalism, Trumpocracy, and Organizing for Social Justice. Please give him a round of applause.
Oh, thank you so much, Tilly. It's such a pleasure. J'aime l'université de Caen et mes élèves. Thank you so much for this invitation to give this talk and to teach here for a while and to get to know everyone. I thank Thierry, I thank Béton Cardin. I also thank Dominique Heureux, who did the magnificent poster, which I absolutely love. I'm going to be taking a copy back with me to the United States. And again, the master's degree students in my 2 seminars, I'm so impressed. I love working with you guys, not just because we eat cookies, but we have so much even sweeter food for thought. C'est très doucement. And so I spend a lot of time in Paris. And as many people know, Paris is the best place in the world to see American movies on the big screen, especially the whole history of American movies, the best. There's a history there that I won't go into because it was compelled to be the best after World War II as part of the Marshall Plan, where Hollywood wanted to have its movies circulated in France, perhaps because it was concerned about France going more à gauche, to the left. So, but that's another story that I won't get into very much. But it's a pleasure to spend. I met my wife in Paris many years ago, one romantic snowy night at the Opera Garnier when we were sitting next to one another and fell in love. And then I worked up my courage and asked her to have a beer at Harry's Bar, the famous expatriate bar. And she said, yes. And the story continues, and we're married and very happy. So you all have a handout. Does everybody have a handout? Does everyone have a handout? That's very good. Okay, so this talk grows out of a book that I'm writing titled Movies and the Americanization of Power. Now, over the past few years, I've been thinking a lot about movies. I mean, for all of the corporate interference that goes on in making movies, in truth, at this point in my career, I admit that I've learned a lot from movies about things that interest me, and I'm mostly interested in cultural criticism. I think of movies, or some movies, as critical resources, and I'm going to tell you a little bit, I'm going to give you just a few sound bites here to hold on to as I try today to be more ambitious, because I find my students are so ambitious at Caen, and give you an overview of the book I'm writing, and then focus on one particular movie that has to do with the fourth point I'll get into. But first I wanted to say something that I brought up to my own students who take my film classes at Wesleyan. That's, I think, is very important. In 1944, the American president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his last year in office, because he would die the next year, gave a State of the Union address, and he presented a second economic Bill of Rights that he would want, that he wanted to see passed, that was never passed. And he was thinking about the soldiers who would be coming home from Europe and from Asia. And he felt, because his whole regime was called a New Deal, that they needed a better deal, and that America would have to be changed in fundamental ways, that they would have to have health care, that they would have to have better housing for everyone, better jobs for everyone, better education for everyone, proper care for the elderly. And for him, you could say, although he didn't put it this way, that you would spell democracy, S-E-C-U-R-I-T-Y, security. So he was thinking of systemic security. Essentially, he was thinking we have to have more. Coming out of the Depression, where there was so much poverty, we have to have more than political democracy. We need economic democracy. So this was never passed. But if it had been passed, and if we move back in time 100 years to the 1830s or 1840s, let's say it had lived back then, and he was interested in passing that then as president and succeeded, what would America have been like? And if it even succeeded in the 1940s in passing that second economic Bill of Rights, would the movies that I'm going to kind of analyze with you have ever been made? If there was real security in America, real homeland security, the real homeland security for Americans. So bear that in mind. Okay, so these are four things I'm exploring with the book. And I'll explain this in just a minute. Soft power and soft capitalism. And the word soft, the best theorist who was the first theorist to use the word soft to analyze America was a Frenchman, Comte Alexis de Tocqueville. And I'll get to him a little bit later. He said, oh, you got to think of America the way they do power? Soft. That's the adjective. And then American unexceptionalism, or capitalism's unexceptionalism, that American ideology will turn into American exceptionalism. And then the American's very good at, soft power, soft capitalism, turning American unexceptionalism into something that will seem like it's American exceptionalism. I didn't finish writing that on the blackboard, I see, or the whiteboard. Dressing down top-down power to make it look like it's bottom-up, which has to do with the very idea of American democracy, we the people representing the people, and the ways in which America is very good at, and movies play a big role here, in mass individualizing Americans, saying to America, you're all individuals, and what impact that has on efforts to organize people for collective change. Okay, so these are some of the things I'm going to be exploring together. Okay, now let me then begin. Okay, now what I'm doing, sometimes I call what I'm doing critical entertainment studies. And entertainment is a very important thing that a lot of Americans are thinking about right now, especially, they've been thinking about it for a long time, but especially because of Donald Trump. Who had a big TV show called The Apprentice, and he thinks of himself as an entertainer. And he always talks about not just votes, but ratings, TV ratings. He's obsessed with TV ratings. And long ago, 42 years ago, a famous film reviewer in America named Pauline Kael said that Americans are becoming entertainment addicts. And Selma Hayek, who's a great Mexican-American actress who Donald Trump tried to date years ago, probably as usual when he was married to someone else. She has said she views his presidency as a continuation of his entertainment career. So entertainment is on the minds of a lot of Americans, scrutinizing what goes on with entertainment. And The film critic that has influenced me the most is someone who writes for a smaller Chicago publication, the Chicago Reader, and his name is Jonathan Rosenbaum. And he talks about entertainment as oppression. Now, I won't go into detail about Jonathan Rosenbaum's work, but of course you've got corporate Hollywood, and you've got marketing departments fooling around with films, censoring films. There's a long, long history of that. And they're mostly interested in movies as commodities. And Jonathan Rosenbaum and I think about, it's very, very subtle if you can take people who are oppressed and make them have fun while they're being oppressed. And it's also very subtle if you can take oppressors of other people and make them have fun while they're oppressing other people by not calling it oppression. So entertainment is a very political thing to think about. And if you have Americans, for example, just to give one example, who experience life as being sort of out of control, and then they want to develop some sense of control, then the idea of using movies to individualize one's sense of agency, one's sense of control, is politically important to think about. And you can just think about, for example, if you can't control the world because of the market you're in or the labor market you're in, and you need a kind of control, how does that have an impact on the way, for example, guns are represented in films? And how many American films have people using guns? That's hard to determine, but in 2015, one person looked at the 100 movie posters of the most successful top 100 best-grossing American films. 20% of the posters alone, just the posters, 20% showed people having guns. And that becomes the control rather than changing the world that's giving you a sense that you're out of control. How does that get made into something that's entertaining, adventurous, dashing, heroic, sexy? You've got your gun. So I'm not an expert on guns, but the other thing too is related to that is the number of films that have one person, whether it's cowboy films, detective films, martial arts films, one person overcoming the many. One person overcoming the many. So if you're in a system and you feel overwhelmed by the system, that you can't control the system, you go to the movies and you get pumped up with a sense of individualism or sense of agency as you see the one somehow overcome the many, even though in your own life that might be a lot harder. So again, entertainment is of great political importance. Now let's see how soft power is a very important concept that I'm going to say in a few minutes that Tocqueville developed in the 1830s, but in 1990, a scholar of diplomatic relations, international relations, named Joseph Nye, developed the concept of soft power. And you can see an important quote on the sheet that I passed out. And he wrote, for example, as an example of this, long before the Berlin Wall fell, in 1989, it had been pierced by American TV and movies. And what he says is that soft, a hard power would be when America would go to war against a country or impose economic sanctions. But soft power has to do, for Joseph Nye, who's very much in favor of this, he's not really critical of this, but soft power has to do with seduction, getting people to do what you want them to do by giving them some kind of payoff, some kind of, let's say, entertainment or set of preoccupations that will entice them so that they do what you want, that want to become Americanized or want to become consumers. And since then, thinking about soft power, some other critics, I won't go into detail about this, have developed the idea of soft capitalism. And here they're mostly thinking about personnel departments, how to get workers to like the work that they're doing through a kind of affective or emotional engineering, emotional management, give them a sense that they're expressing their identity at work. This is very popular in California, in what's called Silicon Valley, where workers often stay through the night and it's as if it's their home. So that's their, soft capitalism for me is a much broader concept. And but what's really important about it is that some of these theorists think about how you get people to go to work even if they don't like the work that they do. And movies, I think, especially through soft power and soft capitalism, can play a key role in that. How do you get people to spend their lives doing work that they'd really rather not do? I'm going to suggest that movies, some movies that interest me, not all movies, but some that interest me, are self-reflexive and think about the fact that they're products of soft power, products of soft capitalism, and get us to think critically about the political and social implications of that. For example, one film that I'll talk about a little bit later, Norma Rae, is about labor organizing. And the scene that I'm about to describe takes place in a bar, and there's an exploited worker who will wind up marrying Norma Rae, who's another worker in a textile mill. And so he says to the union organizer, as they're drinking beers, he says, everything goes to the rich man. And the union organizer says, you get tired of it? And the worker says, when I do, I wash it down with a beer. I wash it down with a beer. Okay, to try to forget that, a little bit of amnesia, and just you feel good for a little bit, a temporary feeling that you can cope with the fact that the rich man in America gets everything. And in some ways, the movie is thinking about, are you washing down that contradiction with a movie, or with entertainment, or with not a soft drink, but soft power? And so movies can be coping devices, and they can be intoxicating. I want to say that some movies have really helped me further theorize soft power and soft capitalism. For example, and I'm not going to go into detail, there's a great movie, a classic called Sullivan's Travels. It was made in 1941. And this movie is about a famous movie director who wants to make a movie about social realism, but he's famous for making romantic screwball comedies. So I won't go into a lot of detail, but the movie, as I read it, winds up thinking about movies as a kind of, and it can be critical of this at times, as a kind of laughter industry, as a kind of laugh it off industry. And so that's very important in the Depression when you are poor, and what do you do? How do you deal with the world? And then you go to a movie and it makes you laugh. So the movie is performing a service, but things basically remain the same once you stop laughing. And the film doesn't go into detail about the redistribution of wealth, but in fact, what it's critical of is, do movies sell people the distribution of laughter, a temporary coping, but is the real solution something more like a redistribution of wealth? And there's another movie titled Pennies from Heaven that came out in 1981. And this is about a salesman. The only way he can stay on the road as a salesman is because he's constantly thinking of songs and movies and dancing, and one of the really, and the film is full of great songs from the 1930s that are very catchy melodies with a lot of hooks. And my favorite is Love is Good for Anything That Ails You. Now, one of the points of this movie, as you see, many bad things happen to this salesman, that some of which he brings on him, to himself, is that love is not enough for everything that ails you, is that movies are not enough for anything that ails you, and in some ways, capitalism certainly is not enough that sells a lot of movies, and the idea that love is everything, that's not enough for everything that ails you. So in some ways, movies can take what produces them, soft power and soft capitalism, as their theme, and give us insights into how this works. Now, what interests me really is what interests the documentary maker, who's very much on the left, Michael Moore. And in 2014, he gave a talk to a convention full of people who make documentaries called documentarians. And his main point was, you're not documentarians. Now, he won Oscars, he won the Palme d'Or for his documentaries, Cannes. You're not documentarians. You are entertainers. You are not making documentaries. You are making movies. Your role is to not to give people castor oil, which is like an old-fashioned medicine that tastes horrible, that's supposed to be good for you. Your role is to give people sugar, and I would add spice. You'll never get anywhere until you reach people. You've got workers coming to your movies on Friday night, and they're exhausted, and they want to go home and go out to the bar or have sex, and they're tired. You've got to entertain them. So, in other words, can movies use soft power almost against soft power? Movies against movies, in a way, on behalf of entertaining social change. Entertaining social change. This is crucial for Michael Moore because he knows he's dealing with a lot of Americans, and this is one of the crucial American problems. Americans who will very vigorously act against their own interests. And how can you enlighten them about that without seeming condescending at all? So he's thinking as a movie maker, like an organizer. And that appeals to me. That's something I want to think about. Now, the other thing is, the idea of the very popular ideology of American exceptionalism. Now, this is a key ideology. Now, a lot of movies will address this directly, and I'm surprised sometimes by how blunt movies can be in coming right out and saying something that you wouldn't expect them to say. For example, on the theme of American exceptionalism. Now, American exceptionalism goes back to 1630. John Winthrop, who became the governor of the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay Colony, and he wrote a sermon on board the ship that was bound for what would be Massachusetts Bay Colony. And he said, New England or Massachusetts Bay Colony will be like a city on a hill. We are the chosen people, the new Israelites. The rest of the world, the rest of the Protestant world will want to imitate us, be like us. And so this is the idea of America as the kind of chosen people. And this changes over time. Of course, in the 19th century, in the 1800s, it becomes manifest destiny. Indians, forget the Indians, it's our land. It's our manifest destiny. This is America. We're the chosen people. But now it's more secular. Now, in the late 1800s, early in the 1900s, through 1920, after the Bolshevik Revolution and the Cold War, more and more this becomes, we don't need socialism in America. Why? We have no classes. We're all individuals. If you work hard enough, try hard enough, are smart enough, you will succeed. So this is the idea. So this is the place where you can come and be yourself. The chosen nation with the chosen people, where opportunity reigns. Now, American writers like Mark Twain and Eugene O'Neill at certain points were very critical of that. Mark Twain, as you see on your sheet, said, this nation in 1901, this nation is like all others that have been spewed upon the earth, ready to fill its pocket. Eugene O'Neill, the great playwright, just after the World War II ended and you had the Cold War, you had the idea of the free world and the communist world, he said, very boldly, telling the world about our American dream, I don't know what they mean. The United States has followed the same greedy rut as every other country. Now, Michael Moore, just to give you one example of a movie in which that questions this in the same way, he in 2009, right after the subprime mortgage crisis and the bailout of banks, he made a movie titled Capitalism, A Love Story. In some ways, it's really better titled or subtitled as Capitalism, A Hate Story. And he's actually showing how very radical capitalism is. He shows people, because of the subprime mortgage crisis, being evicted from their homes on Christmas Day. And in one of his themes is that Americans don't rob banks. Banks rob Americans. And someone who does a kind of political theater, he enacts this by going to Wall Street and putting yellow crime scene, it says crime scene on it, crime scene tape around buildings. And he puts crime scene tape around the New York City Stock Exchange. And he's talking in front of the New York City Stock Exchange behind the crime scene tape, or in front of the crime scene tape, and you see over the New York City Stock Exchange in Wall Street a gigantic American flag. Gigantic. And the point that he's really making is that to what extent is Wall Street, which seems so respectable, and they have their suits and their degrees from the nice universities on their wall, to what extent are they the gangsters and the thugs of America who seem, in his view, seem respectable? To what extent is Wall Street and financialized capitalism more broadly? To what extent are they the criminals? To what extent is that the crime scene? And more broadly, to what extent is America, for all of the American exceptional ideology about freedom and equality, a kind of legalized crime scene? Now, I can give you other examples of this, but I think that I'm going to skip over them. But if you look, I'll just give you one. There's another famous movie titled Wall Street in 1987, and there's a predatory kind of investment trader, but he's ruthless in the film, a kind of financial villain named Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas. And in one of the most famous scenes in American movies, he says at one point, as he's trying to convince some stockholders to support him, he says, "America has become," now think about Donald Trump here, "America has become a second-rate power. Greed," and this is on your sheet, "greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed, you mark my words, will save that malfunctioning corporation, the USA. And then he tells his apprentice a little bit later that the ruling corporate class makes the rules. Now, he says, "you're not naive enough to think we're living in a democracy, are you?" And then a later film, just a couple of years ago, 99 Homes, about a similar kind of person who likes to evict people after the subprime mortgage crisis and makes a lot of money from that. He says to his apprentice, "America doesn't bail out the losers. America was built by bailing out winners, by rigging a nation of the winners, for the winners, by the winners." And here he's replacing the language of the Declaration of Independence, of the people, by the people, for the people. So here, in both Michael Moore and in these films, they're popularizing the idea, or they're suggesting, is democracy a kind of cover-up for a more fundamental thing that America is, a kind of, in their view, a predatory capitalism, a socialism, if you will, as some critics call it, socialism for the rich. So that gets a little bit tricky because Oliver Stone, who made Wall Street, the director, and wrote Wall Street, and Michael Douglas, the actor who played Gordon Gekko, over the years, people have walked up to them and said, thank you for giving us Gordon Gekko. I want to be exactly like Gordon Gekko. I want to make a lot of money. And there's even more disgusting film titled The Wolf of Wall Street, made by Martin Scorsese, came out a couple of years ago with Leonardo DiCaprio playing the role of Jordan Belfort, who's even more disgusting than Gordon Gekko. And one of my students raised his hand and said, well, actually, I hate to say it, because I couldn't even teach this film. It's just too disgusting. And he said, my brother went into Wall Street because he wants to be like Jordan Belfort. So you don't know, even when you do the critique, how it will be responded to. Number three, okay, critiques of Americanized. America's very good at making top-down power look and feel as if it's bottom-up. It's built into the very idea of democracy. And it's the idea that, and again, if you think about Michael Moore's flag that covers up the stock exchange, is the American flag or democracy, in his view, a cover-up for something that's more predatory? Tocqueville helped us think about some of this in the 1830s when he came to America, and it was during the era of Andrew Jackson, when Andrew Jackson was president, and this is the big model for Donald Trump. And he says that in America, he talks about something called soft despotism, elected despotism, democratic despotism. All that sounds very paradoxical, but that's what Tocqueville is seeing, the Frenchman, this French aristocrat, in the 1830s, when he's analyzing American democracy. And he says, in America, the will of man, this is on your sheet, is not shattered but softened. He's talking about soft subjection here. The will of man is not shattered but softened, bent and guided. It does not tyrannize. It devises a sole, tutelary, and all-powerful form of government, but elected by the people. The people console themselves for being in tutelage, or in kind of slavery, by the reflection that they have chosen their own guardians, or what he elsewhere he calls masters, chosen their own masters. And by this system, the people shake off their dependence to vote just long enough to select their master and then relapse into it again. Now, I'm writing about three movies I've been writing about them for a long time. One made in 1941, one made in 1957, and one made in 1976, that are all connected because they all have to do with the way, in each movie there's a Mr. Top Down who needs to get political power, and he needs someone as a kind of front man or a cover who's dressed down, who seems like a man of the people, who can connect with people, who doesn't seem elite. He needs a kind of a front man to gain political power. Donald Trump is more. Now, what's interesting about all three films is Meet John Doe in 1941, Facing It by the director Frank Capra, Facing the Crowd in 1957 by the great director Ilya Kazan, and in 1976, the film Network, written by the great playwright Paddy Chayefsky, and directed by the great director Sidney Lumet. All these three films have a Mr. Top Down who's behind the scenes, who uses a Mr. kind of man of the people, or someone who can connect with the people, more informal, who doesn't put on airs, to gain some kind of power. And so this one thing, for me, this raises questions about how America can dress down the idea that it's a class structure that's very stratified. Now, in this class structure, you have people like Barbara Ehrenreich describing it, and she's a very important social critic in America. And her basic idea is that, for her, the greatest philanthropists in America, the greatest philanthropists who give the money the greatest are the poor people. And who do they give the money to? The rich. Okay? So how the heck does that happen? So I'm going to kind of skip over this and not go into detail. How are we doing on time?
We're doing fine.
So do I have time to show a couple of films? Do I do a film? Okay. I think I'll just show you one film clip And it has to be on my little baby computer. And then we'll do another film clip here. And so if you squint very hard, maybe you can see some of this. But okay, so the three films I'm interested in, what happened is I've been working on them for years and making connections between them, and I'm doing more research, and I'm finding that different people who write little internet articles are saying, oh my God, this film predicts Donald Trump. 1941, Meet John Doe. 1957, Face in the Crowd. Oh my God, it predicts Donald Trump. And then Network, 1970s, oh my God, it predicts Donald Trump. Now, I'm not gonna say a lot about Network, but Network won't have as much to do with the idea of dressing down top-down power, but the idea of what do you do, how do you develop a populism that depends on rage? How do you get, how do you address rage? Now, Network is about that. It's about a news anchor who gets fired. And then he comes to work in a crumpled up, dressed down raincoat, and he basically says to people, I want you to get mad, I want you to say, I'm mad and I'm not gonna take this anymore. I want all of you in America who are watching me, and 60 million people are watching him, to say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore. And lo and behold, 60 million people open their windows in America and yell out, I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore. And what the channel or the network is thrilled with this because it sells. And the network gets rich and richer and richer and richer. They make more and more money off people's anger. And that too connects with Donald Trump. But that's what I'm not gonna talk about. I'm gonna focus more on the dress down. Now, if you can possibly see some of this, this is some film clips from the 1957 film, Face in the Crowd, that was put together by someone who was so shocked by the rise of Donald Trump. He said, oh my God, look at this. It predicts the whole thing. So are you ready? Here we go. And then we'll have the big screen for some other film clips that I'm going to show.
Politics have entered a new stage, the television stage.
This is Mr. Top Down.
Instead of long-winded public debates,
British accent.
Caps or slogans. Time for a change. The mess in Washington. More bang for a buck.
The swamp.
Punchlines and glamour.
Think you underestimate the respect which people
respect?
Are never...
Respect? Did you ever hear of anyone buying any product?
He's the front man.
Tissue because they respect it? You gotta be love, man. Love! This whole country just like my flock of sheep. Rednecks, crackers, hillbillies, houseproud, shut-ins, pea-pickers. Everybody that's got to jump when somebody else blows the whistle. They're mine. I own them. They think like I do. Only they're even more stupid than I am, so I gotta think for them.
I say one thing for him. He's got the courage of his ignorance. I've been writing a book about... I call it Demagogue and Denim.
Denim.
You have only one flaw, the way you've begun to suddenly shoot out of control, and you're beginning to antagonize the press. You're great.
Sound familiar?
Give me a whole bunch of colorful, country-looking characters all sitting around, listening to Lonesome Road sound off about everything from the price of popcorn to the hydrogen bomb. I'm not just an entertainer. I'm an influence, a wielder of opinion, a force. Force. You know, boys,
this is
what really bugs me about our line, because
this TV show.
The way they keep on trying to act like a first-class outfit when their store is having to close up its branches all over the world.
That's right.
He's getting more global every minute.
You're off the air, but he's on the air.
That's over. We'll start shooting people instead of ducks.
Oh, if we ever heard the way that psycho really talks.
Choreography,
Don Crane.
Like this.
You know what the public's like. A cage full of guinea pigs.
Good night, you stupid idiot. Good night, you miserable slob.
There are a lot of trained seals. I toss them a dead fish and they'll flap their flippers.
He's a monster.
He's a monster. Yeah, well,
And that was why the person made this, to suggest that someone else is a monster. Now, there are many connections, of course, between film and Face in the Crowd and Donald Trump. But I mean, Donald Trump, of course, has said he thinks of himself as an entertainer, and he's actually, when the people of Iowa in their primary, in the Republican primary, did not vote for Donald Trump, he called them, and that was the first primary, he called them stupid. The people of Iowa are stupid. And in the film Face in the Crowd, the producer of the show, who made him famous in the first place, wants to expose him, and she leaves the microphone on when he doesn't know that's on, and he calls the people who are watching him morons and stupid and all of that. And so he gets exposed and thrown out. Whereas with the Access Hollywood tapes with Donald Trump, with him grabbing certain parts of the female anatomy and bragging about it because he's a celebrity, that didn't have any effect on him. And he actually said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue in cold daylight and still get elected. Well, we'll see what happens to him down the road. But that's where he stands right now. He's been exposed many times, and he's still in power. But we'll see what happens in the future. So that's the other part of my book that I'm thinking about. And it has very much to do with what's happening in America right now. And Donald Trump is somehow, I'm still working on this myself, managed to seem like, with his Queens accent, with his vulgarity, with his arrogance, he's managed to somehow seem like, and this where this film, some of these films say a lot more about George Bush the second than Donald Trump, but he's managed to seem like an anti-establishment billionaire. So this is a case where you don't have a Mr. Top Down and a front man. He is his own front man, and he is Mr. Top Down. He is the billionaire. He's the two parts combined. So my book is thinking about some of this, but as a longer American tradition that goes back to Alexis de Tocqueville thinking about Andrew Jackson and how he pulled off top-down power looking bottom-up. Okay, so now I want to, now what's the point of all of this? I want to think a little bit more. One big payoff for me, a critical payoff, is to think again about how movies can teach us maybe about organizing, to make organizing a value. How do you change if the movies are identifying some problems that need to be addressed in America, some things that need to be targeted, how do you change that? So I became interested in movies that are about labor organizing. Now, if I were to teach a course on movies and American individualism, I could teach different versions of that course for 300 years and never have one repetition. But I could probably only teach movies about labor organizing for one term, maybe one term. So that's not what movies tend to focus on, but there are some, and they can be very, very important. So one point I want to make is that Americans are already organized even before you think about officially organizing Americans. And movies play a key role in that, in getting Americans to imagine themselves as individuals, as ways of gaining potency, that sometimes in terms of gender, men dominating women, or using guns, or being sexy to gain power. But how do you get power in a system that makes power in some ways difficult to get when that power would change the whole system? So one thing that a labor union organizer has to think about is the fact that people are already organized in certain ways by the culture, by the hegemony, by the ideology, and that labor organizer has to do with that. So what are the ways in which movies are not only officially about labor organizing or community organizing, but in what ways do movies teach us about why organizing is so hard? in America. So again, in some cases, you have movies that are blowing the whistle or exposing what other movies do that disorganizes people. But that disorganizing is itself a form of organizing, in the sense that you're shaping people who don't want to be organized politically, or don't want to be organized economically. What do films teach us about this? Now, I'll just give you one quote from another film before I get into Norma Rae. A couple of films. One is from Inequality for All that features the important nowadays social critic, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. And that film is Inequality for All. And there's one chilling scene that just came out a few years ago where one worker is saying, I don't want to unionize. And this explanation is on your sheet. And he says, I'm a capitalist. He's saying to Robert Reich, okay, I'm not going to unionize. I'm not going to do it. I'm a capitalist. I say for these people making their millions, that's fantastic. I could have done the same thing if I went to school and had the brains for it. I do not. So I'm a laborer. And that here is the power of individualism in America, the kind of individualism or individualizing that gets you to blame yourself for your own circumstances, perhaps for your own oppression or exploitation. Who's to blame? Not the system. You're to blame. You too, if everybody within American exceptionalism, if we're all equal and we're all individual and we all have opportunity in America, if you failed, it's your fault. Okay, so that film has a chilling scene where he's actually convinced that he shouldn't organize it because it's entirely his fault that he's being exploited. There's another film about labor organizing in 1920 during about miners who are very exploited, and that came out in 1987. It's titled Matewan. It's about West Virginia, Matewan, West Virginia. It's by the great director John Sayles. He's got this great scene where you've got African Americans playing the blues harp, and you've got Italian immigrants playing mandolin, and you've got country people, hillbillies in West Virginia, playing bluegrass guitar and bluegrass violin, and they're all making music together. And he's trying to say something about in order to win, we have to overcome these divisions. And there's a union organizer there who says, if you stand alone, if you stand alone, he's telling the workers, you're just so much, excuse my language, shit mailed to these people. He says, don't be divided. Basically, he's saying, don't be divided and conquered. If you're divided, you're conquered. He says, white against colored, native against foreign. You work, the bosses don't. Management doesn't. And who's the target? He said, that's all you got to know about the enemy. We got to organize. We got to take care of each other. Every man who walks out on his own steam, we take into the union. Okay, now I'm going to move into a film clip about this is from the film Norma Rae, which came out in 1979. And it was directed by a director who had been blacklisted in the McCarthy era. And his name is Martin Ritt. And the movie was supposed to be not very successful. Martin Ritt was quite famous, and they approached some of the famous political actresses of the time to play the lead role, Jane Fonda, Susan Sarandon, and they said, no, can't do this. And so they found that somebody was on a silly TV show called The Flying Nun. So it wasn't supposed to be a success. It got many Oscars. It was a box office hit, huge, mega selling movie in 1979, just before Ronald Reagan would take over as president in 1980 and break unions. American workers that are unionized are only 10% of the workers. It's very different from France. It's a serious problem in America. This has getting more and more serious. And when this was movie was played at the Cannes Film Festival, the people at the Cannes Film Festival stood up and gave it a standing ovation for a half an hour, this movie. It's a very important movie that beat the odds. Now, the thing is, what I'm interested in is thinking about how that is you kind of using soft power to popularize critique, to get critique out there, and to make organizing something that people would be interested in. And I think I'm going to suggest, in order to do that, it's got to have some romance, it's got to have some, you know, men and women and gender and something like romantic and a little bit sexy going on. But it's also taking on a whole range of issues that we would regard as feminist in relation to gender. The movie says a lot about masculinity. The movie says a lot about how difficult it is if you want to popularize critique or if you want to organize. How, with a movie, or if you're an organizer, do you tell someone you've been duped, you've been fooled? It's a confidence game, a con game. You're being taken advantage of. You're actually working against your own interests. And that's very hard, but that's a theme that the movie takes up. So if we could see the first film clip now, you will see the union organizer who's Jewish, who's very left of center, Gush, coming down to a North Carolina textile mill. And what he wants to do is he comes into town. He's already almost arrested by the sheriff, who says, get out of town. So you've got the sheriff working with the company, and it's a company town. The textile mill dominates the town. It's the main source of employment. And he's knocking on the door, on the porch, and he's trying to convince the father of a mill family that, give me a room because I want to hang out with a mill family and learn more about the mill hands, because he knows he has to make a connection with the workers in order to succeed as an organizer. And he's finding it very difficult. And there are many visual parts of this that I won't go into completely, but you'll see a screen door. And he never gets past the screen. There's always a screen between him until he never gets past the screen until he insults the father. And the father, he calls him, I guess it's a Yiddish term, schlemiel, for a fool, somebody's been fooled. He doesn't even know what that means, the guy from North Carolina. But he knows it's an insult of some kind from this New Yorker. This, he calls him a communist, a Jew. So he knows he's been insulted. And then he opens the door. And he says, you better get out of here until, or else the dog will bite you. And then his daughter, Norma Ray, who is behind him, you'll see her behind him, not saying anything until the end. He said, Dad, we don't have a dog. And then the labor organizer turns and leaves, and it turns, the woman is the one who listens, not the man. And what you'll see from this scene is that the film is really teaching us about this organizer. As smart as he is, he has a lot to learn because he's making a lot of mistakes with this group. But he's able to get through to the woman who is, quote unquote, I can't go into too many details, screwed in various ways as a woman worker in the textile mill. She and her father work in the textile mill, and the mother. And one of his challenges is the scene, the movie opens after the opening song, which is about everyday life growing up in a mill town, with this boom, 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 and machinery just hits you. It hits you, it hits your ears. And the first scene is of the mother going deaf because of the machinery. And then you see other people wearing earplugs. And part of that is a visual metaphor and an oral metaphor for people who are deaf to any kind of arguments that will say you're acting against your own interests. You need to organize. So how does he make these people not deaf? How does he communicate with them? And that's part of what the film is about. So the film is not about organizing this mill. It's about using a film to organize people at the same time. So it's impressively self-reflexive. So let's see the scene together, and thank you. Penny. Maybe.
Mr. Richard?
That's right, Vernon Richard.
Note his hands.
My name is Reuben Warshawski.
Warshawski. What kind of name is that?
The kind you have to spell for telephone operators and head waiters.
What do you want?
I'd like to get me a room with a Mill family.
What for? We got a hotel, 12 rooms, got a motel, 36 rooms.
I want to get to know some mill hands close up.
Why is it?
I'll tell you, Mr. Witcher. I just got into town about an hour ago. Hi, how are you? I parked my rented car, got out. Before I had a chance to adjust my crotch, the chief of police was on me saying, who are you? I don't know you. What the hell are you doing here? So I told him I was a labor organizer. Come to put a union in the OP Henry textile mill. And he said, the hell you are, boy. And he gave me a ticket and told me to get my ass elsewhere right quick.
He was dead right, too. As far as I'm concerned, all of you people are communists, are agitators, are crooks, are Jews, are all four rolled together. Every time you people come into a town, the folks get thrown out of their jobs.
Excuse me, sir. Busted in. Do you mind if I ask you a question? How much do you make an hour?
I make $1.33 a frame.
And when did you have your last cost of living raise?
I haven't had that.
With all due respect, Mr. Witcher, with today's inflation, that makes you a bit of a schlemiel.
Kaboom.
You calling me some kind of a name?
You're underpaid. You're overworked. They're shafting you right up to your tonsils. You need me, sir.
I think maybe if you run real fast, you're gonna get back to your car before my dog bites you.
What are you telling that for? We ain't got a dog.
You don't need me.
Okay, you can stop. Thank you, Penny. Okay, and then so later on, and we're gonna watch one more scene, and I'm gonna end everything. You can stop it. Okay. Okay, if you can. There we go. Okay, so now later on, she'll tell him he's got a sign, or he talks to people coming into the factory gate. And again, as Barbara Ehrenreich says, the social critic I mentioned before, in America, democracy, okay, that's great. You get to vote and you got political democracy, but democracy ends at the factory gate. Democracy ends at the workplace door. And this is something that you see here. So he's in front of the gate and he's actually dressing down more. He's learning, he's got to be more careful. He's got to learn how to speak their language. He is from New York. He's got a girlfriend in New York who went to Harvard. And he loves to go to the opera and read the New York Times on Sunday. And he's got to enter their world. And he's trying to get workers' attention at the factory gate. And she says, you're never going to do this. You're never going to do this. If I can't understand you, they're not going to understand you. You've got to simplify it. And then he says later, thank you, I got it down to two syllables. And this is going to be crucial in just a minute. And she becomes the main organizer in the factory because he's more limited in what he can do. But at some point, what this film also, listen, this guy's from the North. This guy's offending his Southern identity. He's offending the fact this guy's a Christian and Reuben Warshawski is a Jew. This guy's on the left. The Reuben Warshawski, the union organizer, and he's really like, I'm the man. I don't need help. I don't need a union. I don't need organizing. I don't need any of you communist Jews, crooks, and whatever. I don't need you. I'm independent. I'm a man. And that Vernon, who's dressed in white shirt and blue overalls, which will be significant in another minute, he winds up dropping dead at work later in the film, literally dropping dead when he asks his supervisor for a break. And he said, well, Vernon, your break is coming up in another 5 or 10 minutes. Why don't you just hang in there until your real break? And then he continues, and then he collapses from a heart attack, and he's dead. He actually drops dead at work. But it's a film, it's about masculinity. It helps. And another key factor is that for the next scene, which will be the final scene and I'll end the lecture, is that one of the last things they do to try to prevent the union from unionizing in the factory is, it's North Carolina. So what they do is they put a sign up that say, blacks are taking over the mill. Blacks are taking over the mill. So the strategy is divide and conquer. So one of the points, just like in that other film I mentioned, Meituan, is that you need to get over these constructions of difference. Black versus white, male versus female, or even class or region. You've got to work together. You've got to. This is what the division of people is, what prevents people from understanding, you know, where's the real problem and what's the target. It's the top down that's going to want to justify itself in all kinds of ways. So we'll see. Do we have time for a final scene? We sure? You sure? Okay. And this is number 26. Scene number 26. This is about blacks are taking over the mill, and that's illegal. And she wants to write it down. You know, they're all men surrounding her. And they're pushing her around.
Don't put the pencil and paper away. You stop what you're doing right now. You're going to leave. The law is going to come after you and take you right out of this plant.
Mr. Mason, I started this, and I'm going to finish it.
She's going to give this to the labor union organizer who knows that he can prosecute them. And they don't want her to give it to him.
Let's go to my office, Norma. Why did you make those personal phone calls on company time?
They're looking for an excuse to fire her now. Look at the arms crossed, just like Vernon at the screen door.
Mr. Mason, no one around here is on my side, and I'm not going to leave until I set down all your names on this piece of paper.
Lady, I want you off the premises now.
Mental premises as well.
I want you out of here right quick.
Now see what she does. Again, gender politics. That's the factory. The deafening machines. Storms out. This is a security guard. That's her mother and her best friend. Now she's turning the tables. She becomes top down. Because no one can hear her, so she uses the sign. Above her head, 360 degrees. That's her mom, who went deaf. Hard motion. Women turning it off. Women get the ball rolling. above her head. And he turns off the power. And she turns off the power. That, okay, we can turn it off now. Penny, that's a good, I'd love to see more with you, but let me make a couple of comments about this. That's the sheriff, and she will, now, look, now there's gonna be, it's okay. A smile in her face. Now, at various points, she looks worried, but she's up there. There are a lot of visual components to this film. The men who are surrounding her in the office, there are six guys or seven guys in the office, and they're like this. And that's exactly what the father was behind the screen door. Remember, like his body language, and she was standing behind the father. Now she's not standing behind the father, who's now dead. She's turned the tables. She's on top of the table. Now, what's interesting too is the tall black worker who's interested in you, and the black workers know, like, we have to be careful. This is the South. I mean, you're talking about people getting killed if they resist, if you're African American, right? But they know this whole thing is all about the memo that she's trying to copy that say blacks are trying to take over the mill. Now the black worker, the tall one, who actually is the first one to literally shut off the power. And the first three persons who turn off the machines are white women. And then there's a black woman. And then some more white women. And then number seven is a white man. And then a couple more white women. And then another black man, not the tall black man. And then a couple of other people. And then he's really important. He's got the pole there. He literally turns off the power. This is taking the power away from the company. And then the other woman, the other source of power, that takes, and then boom. And then you've got quiet, and they're not deaf anymore. And then they can take the earplugs out. And so they're all, and the tall black worker is dressed in exactly, except for his hat, the same outfit as Vernon, the father, behind the screen door. The blue overalls with the white t-shirt. And so this is a very powerful movie that's reflecting on what it's going to take to get this movie to be popular, that carries over into what it's going to take more generally to organize people. So those are the sorts of things I'm thinking about with the book. And the final thing that I will say here, just as a way of summing up more than that can be summed up, is that in this book, Movies and the Americanization of Power, I'm thinking of the distinct elements of an Americanized construction of power and class. And I'm also thinking about American unexceptionalism and how they go together, how some things are Americanized, but on the other hand, the system itself has many similarities to other forms of capitalism and class power. I'm thinking about what these movies can tell us about what progressive social change, thinking progressively, and organizing what it's up against. And in fact, I think that I'm looking at some movies that are in some ways going against other movies and yet learning from them, because movies tell us a lot about what gets popular. And the interesting thing, I've listed some of the movies about labor organizing on the sheet that I handed out. I won't mention them all now, but almost all of them involve women helping the strike. Even when men are the only ones on strike, there's something going on in these films that go back to a great film made by blacklisted filmmakers in 1952, early 1950s, called Salt of the Earth. And women play a key role in this. In some later movies, you've got elements of romance. How do you make organizing attractive, appealing, dashing, romantic, sexy? So they're doing the things that movies will do, and even in terms of agitprop patterns, agitation propaganda is a form of theater that these movies are learning from, and you often have the figure of the young leader, and in a lot of these films, there's a young leader who's sometimes kind of sexy or romantic or dashing. So these movies are learning about what buttons to press to get Americans interested in movies, but it also has larger implications of how you organize, how you get people to not succumb to being divided and conquered by constructions of difference, and to think about what's the real problem, what's the real target, what's the real enemy? And also, what mix of things do you need to make people interested? How, interest, getting interest, it's, these movies are teaching us lessons about critical fascination, as well as popularizing, maybe even kind of form of critical soft power. And so when I leave all of this, as I'm working on this book, something kind of horrible occurred to me. What I would prefer is to maybe the system, as an American, especially with Donald Trump as the president now, I could say that it would be better to have a more humane, more generous, a more beneficent top-down power structure that's better to the bottom. That's something I would prefer to a more predatory top-down power structure that just says we're about equality, we're about individuality, we're about freedom, we're about democracy, but still more and more having the poor give welfare to the rich, or socialism for the rich. I would prefer a more humane top-down power structure, but some of these films are making me think more and more about, is that the goal? A more humane top-down power structure in its domination of bottom-up? Or do you want to think about something beyond that, whether or not you need a top or you need a bottom, and what would that look like, and what are the implications? Thank you.